This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Fresh Air critic at large, John Powers, has written a new book about our increasingly polarized culture. The book focuses on the years of the George W. Bush presidency. John covers what he describes as the artificiality of our political discourse, the shrieking of our pop culture, and the babble of information that bombards us every day. The book is called Sore Winners. John writes a weekly column on media and culture for LA Weekly. In September, he'll return to his position as film critic for Vogue. Do you think that politics have become part of popular culture? Like, there used to be this big, you know, delineation between politics and pop culture. Do you think more and more politics crosses into the territory of pop culture?
No, I think actually that's one of the great transformations of my life, is that I think when I was growing up, you actually had the political figures in Washington, D.C., and they were making their decisions. And then you had Elvis in popular culture or the Beatles in popular culture. Over the last 40 years, what's happened is that the two have begun to mesh. And so what's fascinating about it is that simultaneously, popular culture carries more obvious political meanings, and actually popular culture becomes a way that people talk about politics. And at the same time, political figures become more like pop culture figures, so that Donald Rumsfeld isn't simply the Secretary of Defense. He's this great performer.
So do you think now that politics has kind of crossed over into the world of pop culture, that the value of politicians is measured in part by their value as celebrities?
Oh, yes. I think if you actually look at the complaints that people make about John Kerry, you know, there are the political complaints about him being a flip-flopper and so forth. But there's also the complaint that basically he's not an exciting, fun, entertaining guy. If you watched Bill Clinton the other night, you realize that, oh, that here is a guy who is, above all, a star. You know, he actually has all sorts of political virtues, but he also has the charisma that makes him a celebrity. It makes people want to see him. And that's truer and truer than ever. And I think that as people's experience of politics comes more and more through media outlets rather than through the daily life of actually being active in politics in their own community, that's going to be truer and truer. That you actually have to be a good showman, I think, to really get ahead, or at least you have to have people who put on a good show around you. I think probably the interesting thing about George Bush is that he's the latter, whereas Clinton was himself the show. I think what George Bush has done is to make himself sort of the anti-show. He's the straightforward, regular guy who, in fact, doesn't present himself as a show. But then he has people around him like his advisor, Karl Rove, who know how to present that regular guy image in the best possible way.
Now, you've pointed out in a recent column that presidential campaigns have come to take on narratives as if they were Hollywood films. What's an example of that?
Yes. Well, I think that, you know, if you look back at the 2000 campaign, when Al Gore ran against George Bush, what was fascinating was that early on, that somehow it was decided, and it's never clear who quite decided it, but it became the conventional wisdom that George Bush was a good regular guy who wasn't so smart, and that Al Gore was kind of a priggish guy who was smart but also a liar. And no matter what happened during the course of that election, did either of those guys ever quite escape that particular perception? So that anything that Al Gore said that seemed the slightest bit suspicious was used as evidence of the fact that he's not honest. Whereas every time George Bush stumbled over a word, that was taken as further proof that he doesn't know anything. For me, the irony of that was that if you actually look back at that election, the person who ran the dumb campaign and who was dumb during that election was Al Gore. And the person who I think was actually not, who didn't present himself quite as honestly, is George W. Bush. You know, and so for me, the funny thing is that probably there was a flip-flop in relation to what the actual narrative was, as opposed to the official narrative that was presented by the media.
In what way do you think Al Gore was dumb, and in what way do you think George W. Bush was dishonest?
Yes. Well, Al Gore was dumb in a variety of ways. I think one of the major ways he was dumb was that he didn't realize, one, that you actually have to get along with the media. He was actually very, very distant and detached from the media. The second thing was he ran away from the Clinton legacy. There's a remarkable moment in Joe Klein's book on Clinton where a member of the Bush family says, you know, that they could never understand why Gore didn't turn to Bush in one of the debates and say to Bush, George, what exactly is it you don't like about peace and prosperity? But in fact, Gore was so busy making himself his own man that, in fact, he detached himself from what was clearly the most winning thing that he had going for him, being part of what most Americans thought of as a successful administration. The Bush case is slightly different because Bush, for much of his life, had been presented as a centrist, and in fact, in Texas had governed as a centrist. But as we've seen over the last few years, that I think no one, either in left or right, would say that George Bush is a centrist figure. In fact, he's very much a man of the right. But in presenting himself as a compassionate conservative, he was clearly doing the triangulation thing that Clinton himself had done in the previous elections, which is to say, you try to stake out the center by taking over many of the issues that belong to the other party and trying to suggest that you are that centrist figure. In fact, George Bush is not a centrist figure. In fact, you know, Al Gore was dumb during that election.
How do you think the narrative of the George W. Bush story has changed in the past 4 years? When he was running for the presidency the first time, he was, for a lot of people, the guy you wanted to have a beer with, you know, a regular guy. But he's been the president for nearly 4 years, so his regular guyness has probably diminished by virtue of having been the president for several years now. So do you think the story's changed?
Yeah, the story's changed several times. I mean, you know, one of the fascinating things about any presidency, and you know, the Bush presidency is no different, is that we get various myths built up around the president. At different points, the media decides that this is how we're going to present the guy. You know, at one point he was dumb. At another point, he's a regular guy. At another point, he was the CEO president. You know, that one didn't last very long. But, you know, there was a time when you kept hearing, you know, he went to Harvard Business School. The big transformation in Bush's presidency came with 9/11, where he went from a guy who was basically considered someone who was sort of an ordinary, regular guy on the right to a wartime leader. And in the book, I write about the Prince Hal scenario, which is very much, you know, based on Shakespeare's Henry plays, about the young wastrel guy who isn't doing very much, but who then, because history demands it of him, rises to the occasion. And if you look in the months after 9/11, there are dozens, perhaps hundreds of cases where important journalists would make reference to George Bush being like Prince Hal in the Shakespeare play, a guy who was underestimated, or as he liked to put it, misunderestimated, but who then came through on the big occasion to fight this epic battle. The one that followed that was the negative one, which I call in the book the transformation of Bush into Moby W, because among the people who dislike him, he became a figure that transcended politics, became an almost metaphysical figure, the white whale that Ahab is chasing. You know, that it's one of the, you know, one of the striking features of the Bush years is that the level of polarization is so hysterical. So that, you know, I know a lot of people who don't just think that they dislike George Bush, or that even that he's a bad president, they think he has to be the worst president in the history of the country, and he's a genuinely evil man. You know, this didn't just start with Bush. It was also true of the Clinton years.
Now, John, this book is about popular culture and the media during the Bush administration. Do you think that pop culture is affected by who's in the White House?
Yes. I think pop culture is partly affected by who's in the White House, but I think that what's more important is the way that we think of pop culture, depending on who's in the White House. You know, and it's an important distinction to draw, because really most presidential figures, you know, don't have that much interest in popular culture. George W. Bush certainly doesn't. You know, one of my favorite stories about him on the campaign trail in the year 2000 was when somebody asked him about the show Sex and the City, and he got mad because he thought the person was prying into his personal life. You know, that Bush is not very interested in popular culture. But we tend to read the tone and feeling of the country through the presidency. And that therefore we start interpreting the pop culture through the feeling that of the politics. And in fact, then the pop culture starts reflecting on the political figures as well. And I think that's precisely what's happened during the Bush years, is that you see shows that clearly George W. Bush didn't create. They weren't created in response to him. But somehow some of those shows seem more or less metaphorically apt. They actually resonate in a different way.
What are some of the shows that fit that?
Yes. Well, I think that one of the defining features of our time is what I call, you know, populist social Darwinism, which is to say that we're obsessed with the idea of winners and losers. And in fact, that one of the part of the genuine feel of the Bush years are all these reality game shows like Survivor, like American Idol, and like The Apprentice, which are basically all about this creating this group of people who are clearly winners, and then other groups of people being treated as if they were losers. And I think that is one of the defining ideological features of our society at the moment, which probably contributed perhaps to Bush's winning. Certainly, you know, American Idol or Survivor weren't created by George W. Bush, but they seem particularly resonant at the moment.
How do you think winners and losers, in a larger way, is fitting into American culture now?
Yes. Well, I think that, you know, every culture always has people who triumph and are successful. But I think we live at one of those moments in history where the gap between the people at the top and the rest of us seems larger than ever. And it's not simply a question of money. It's a question of it's a question of power. It's a question of fame. If you live now and live in our media culture, you're bombarded 24 hours a day by stories about people who are successful businessmen, who are political figures, who are world famous stars. That in fact, you sense that there's this huge world out there of winners. And in fact, that makes the rest of us feel like losers. The interesting thing about this particular moment is that even though we've always had winners and people who feel like losers, the winners now are so obnoxious. You know, that Americans used to be thought of as really good winners. But in fact, we now live at a point where actually people, you know, aren't such good winners. You know, whether it's Donald Trump, you know, making it with the tagline, "You're fired," or whether it's, you know, the young high school athlete LeBron James turning up at high school in his brand new $40,000 car, you know, even though he's still another high school student, or Bill O'Reilly telling you how many books he's sold, or Donald Rumsfeld, you know, basically dressing down reporters, asking him questions as if they were no smarter than oysters. The official style of winners these days is to be kind of a sore winner. They're not gracious. That in fact, they actually suggest that they should be winning, and if you question that, there's something wrong with you.
Now, you say in your book, Sore Winners, that the media has a taste for extreme positions, and you write about some of the either-ors that the media helps force people into. Either or is fueled by the media's taste for extreme positions. So, and you say these are specious either ors. For example, you either supported invading Iraq or you were pro-Saddam. You either dislike frivolous pop culture or you lack values. Can you talk about these either ors and what you think is presenting this kind of false dichotomy?
Well, actually, you know, that either ors are very dramatic. You know, that if you watch the good talk show hosts. You know, if you take someone like Bill O'Reilly, who's a very skillful talk show host, he always poses questions as an either-or question. Because if you say, "What do you think about this?" someone might give you an answer that's neither either nor or, but something in between, and there's no drama in that. So that in fact, what you want, you know, in media coverage of things is to have a vivid position which allows people to argue clearly and vividly, because people aren't always paying full attention. So you want that excitement that comes from a head-on collision rather than a discussion of three or four or five possible points of view. If you take the example that you mentioned about either you support invading Iraq or you're objectively pro-Saddam, you know, of course at some fundamental level, that's nonsense. You know, it's simply not true that you are objectively pro-Saddam if you weren't for invading Iraq. There are many ways you could have thought of trying to bring Saddam's regime down without invading Iraq. But as we now discuss these things in politics, you actually have to be that way. You know, you can flip it, because the left is often as guilty, maybe just as often as guilty of this as the right, is that, I mean, I knew people who opposed invading Iraq who would say to me, "Aren't you aware that the United States helped overthrow Salvador Allende in Chile?" And I would say, "Well, yes, I am aware of that, but that actually doesn't mean that it's wrong if you wanted to overthrow Saddam. It's not the same thing." You know, in the one case, you're overthrowing an elected official. In the other case, you're overthrowing a dictatorship. Those aren't oppositions. But we're now taught to think in terms of oppositions, and certainly the successful media shows tend to push opposition, the drama and the conflict of it.
It's also easier to get your position in a short answer, in a short soundbite, if you're seeing things in black and white.
Yes, you know, I mean, black and white is vivid. You know, and political discussions, I think, often now take the form, you know, they're kind of like movie trailers in a way. You know, there's that strange moment in the history of movie trailers where the movie trailer became so important that, in fact, movies began being shot in order to contain stuff that would look good in the trailer. Similarly, in political discussions, ideas that now come out are chosen because they will actually look good in the soundbite, or that you can actually advertise them as having something that's really exciting and hot, that has a lot of pop. You know, so that the idea that you would actually have a nuanced position on something, you know, is a term of abuse. You know, even among Democrats, you often hear people attacking John Kerry on the grounds that he's too nuanced, which, you know, in your normal life, you would probably think, you know, that's not so bad. If you think of, you know, being at your office with your boss, you know, you probably don't want a boss who sees purely things in black and white. He's either really happy with you or he hates you. You know, you might want a boss who actually thinks, well, you're doing a good job some of the time, you're not doing such a good job the other time, but in fact, we're all for you. But in the world of the media landscape, that kind of nuance is considered to be a vice. You know, it's not simply a bore, it's considered a vice.
My guest is media critic John Powers, and he has a new book called Sore Winners. Well, John, you live in Los Angeles, and you've written about movies and about actors for years. Now you have a Republican governor who is an actor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. And, you know, at the same time, many conservatives see Hollywood as the enemy of all the values that they hold dear. How do you reconcile that there are several actors from Hollywood who have become political leaders, including Ronald Reagan, Clint Eastwood, Arnold Schwarzenegger, even Charlton Heston, who headed the NRA? How do you reconcile that with this sense that, you know, Hollywood is the anti-value place?
Well, I think what's interesting about it is that, you know, the idea of Hollywood as the anti-value place, you know, is a very complicated argument for conservatives to make, because of course Hollywood is also like one of the great bastions of free market capitalism, you know, and Daniel Bell, the thinker, famously wrote, you know, about the cultural contradictions of capitalism, that one of the fascinating things about the capitalist world is that many of the values that traditional conservatives would hold dear are in fact challenged by the very capitalist enterprises that they also champion. If you take someone like Rupert Murdoch as an example, you know, Rupert Murdoch is not only the man who runs Fox News or owns Fox News, he's also the person who put on The Simpsons and Married with Children and In Living Color, you know, and many of the raunchiest shows that have ever been on American TV come out of that same thing, because it's about making money. And, you know, so that for conservatives, the Hollywood problem is that they actually support the money-making aspect of Hollywood. They don't like the particular products that come out. If you move to the question of why so many of the people who've made it big in politics have been conservative, I think it's because the myth-making machinery of Hollywood is particularly good in political terms at manufacturing iconic figures of authority and male power and responsibility. And if you look at the Hollywood figures who've made it big, whether it's Clint Eastwood or Ronald Reagan or Arnold Schwarzenegger, they tend to come across as very male, very confident. They're confident in their authority and their power. And then the Hollywood myth-making machine actually works to enhance that, to make them more powerful. And clearly that has a much greater electoral appeal than, for instance, the neurosis and passion of a James Dean or Marlon Brando. Americans are much more drawn to iconic masculinity. And in an interesting way, just in this year's presidential election, for example, you clearly see that, you know, both John Kerry and George Bush are in their ways offering different models of iconic masculinity. George Bush is the sheriff. You know, that he's the wanted, dead or alive guy. He's the Texan who talks like a Texan. That's a very male authority idea. John Kerry's countering that by being basically the war hero, another source of male authority.
You know, we are told that we live in a very divided country now of red states and blue states and so on. When you live in Los Angeles, or
yes,
just outside Los Angeles. Your parents live in Des Moines.
Yes.
When you go visit them, do you feel like you're visiting a different culture? I mean, has the difference between Los Angeles and Des Moines changed at all in your mind?
No, I think there's almost no difference in some, you know, between Iowa and Los Angeles in many cultural things. You know, the great illusion of the red state, blue state idea was that somehow that if you went to Alabama that 99% of the people voted for Bush and 1% for Gore, or that if you went to California, it was the same thing. In fact, you know, that's a false idea. The truth was, you know, in the red state, blue state idea was that almost all the red and blue states were extremely close. There were some exceptions, of course. But in fact, that in Alabama, you know, there are 40% of the people who are officially blue state types. And in California, there are 40% who are red state types. You know, Iowa was an extremely close vote. And when I go to visit my folks in Iowa, I'm struck by the fact that I don't run into, you know, people who are incomprehending about what it could be like to live on the coast. You know, I don't meet people who think, you know, who only watch Fox News, which seems to be one of the great ideas that many people have, is that once you're in the red state, everybody watches Fox News. You know, you don't find that. What you find is something that is a farm state, but that in many ways resembles a lot of what I see in Los Angeles.
John Powers, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's my pleasure.
John Powers is the author of the new book, Sore Winners. He's also Fresh Air's critic at large. He writes a column on media and culture for LA Weekly. And in September, he returns to his position as film critic for Vogue magazine.